Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
It's Tuesday, the 15th of March, and a very good morning to you. Welcome to Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, the possible motives of the jihadists behind the deadly attack on a beach resort in Ivory Coast.
Al-Qaeda is trying to drive a wedge, especially in countries like Ivory Coast, which have got a predominantly Muslim north and very much a Christian south, which have already seen wars.
And the second part of a major Deutsche Welle investigation into the misery of human trafficking.
And besides, if you are alone in the desert and your car breaks down, many people usually die on the road because there is no chance of any help.
Stay tuned to this edition of Africa Link.
Top story.
In Ivory Coast, soldiers armed with assault rifles were patrolling the deserted beaches of the resort town of Grand Bassam one day after gunmen killed 18 people there. That death toll includes three Ivorian Special Forces troops. Among the foreign nationals who died was Enrico Gross, the 51-year-old head of Germany's Goethe Institute in Ivory Coast. In Berlin, the German government has added its voice to the international chorus of protest condemning the attack, in which suspected jihadists stormed three hotels and sprayed the nearby beach with bullets. Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, Aqim, has claimed responsibility for the raid. In this fact box, Fred Mavuni and Eunice Wanjuru tell us more about this deadly, shadowy group.
Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, Aqim, has its roots in the Algerian civil war of the early 1990s, but it has since evolved to take on a more international Islamist agenda.
The conflict in Algeria was brutal, killing about 150,000 people. Its peak was in the 1990s, when the most feared militant organization, the Armed Islamic Group, rejected the promised amnesty and continued a violent campaign to establish an Islamic State. By then it had split, with the most extreme faction calling itself the Salafist Group for Preaching and Combat.
In 2006, this militant group joined forces with Al-Qaeda, and in January 2007, it announced that it had changed its name to Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb to reflect its new commitment.
Intelligence sources saw this alignment to Al-Qaeda as a far more worrying development, as Al-Qaeda had succeeded in persuading North Africa's Islamist extremists to take a more global view.
In 2002, the head of the US Africa Command said he believed that Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, Boko Haram in West Africa, and the Somali Islamist group Al-Shabaab were coordinating their efforts.
Shortly after this intelligence information was released, seven bombs exploded in Algeria's eastern Kabylia region, killing six people, and in April 2007, at least 30 people were killed in bomb attacks.
In September 2007, a suicide bomb attack in Batna targeted the motorcade of Algeria's president Abdelaziz Bouteflika. The president was not injured, but 20 people were killed.
In November 2011, a German was killed and three other foreigners kidnapped by Aqim in the tourist city of Tombuctu in northern Mali.
June 26, 2015, an attack claimed by the Islamic State killed 38 foreign tourists in Tunisia. And later in November 2015, a terror attack at Radisson Blue Hotel in Mali's capital Bamako left at least 21 people dead.
2 months later, a similar attack happened in Burkina Faso's capital Ouagadougou, killing about 30 people.
The attacks in Burkina Faso and Mali were thought to be an eye-opener for security forces in West Africa, but it was too early for Ivorians to avoid the militant attacks on three hotels in the popular seaside town of Grand Bassam that took place on Sunday. The attack has claimed the lives of 18 people. Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, AQIM, claimed responsibility for the attacks.
Fred Mavuni and Eunice Wanjiru. Later today, France will be sending two senior ministers to Ivory Coast in a gesture of solidarity with the West African nation. Let's take a closer look at this story. What does the attack tell us about the jihadists' intentions in West Africa, assuming their claim of responsibility stands up to scrutiny? I put that question to Ayo Johnson, freelance journalist and director of the news outlet Viewpoint Africa.
Clearly, Al-Qaeda is showing that it has the capabilities that many thought had dwindled, showing that it wants to compete toe-to-toe with ISIL, another terrorist group that's attacking other places in the world. But Al-Qaeda has shown most recently that it has the appetite, as it's been seen, attacks in Mali and Burkina Faso, and of course, choosing another soft target in the Ivory Coast, one that's frequented by many Westerners, a very beach resort environment of which many are now dead, many are fearful for their own lives, especially as many of the gunmen are still out there. But also, I think it shows an escalation of Al-Qaeda's capabilities in using countries which it knows have got porous borders.
How much of a surprise was this attack, bearing in mind that there have been similar ones elsewhere in the region?
Well, it was kind of expected, but many analysts, many experts had said Al-Qaeda more than likely would expand its operation from the Maghreb into West Africa. We know already that they have a very close relationship with Al-Shabaab, who've already maintained a very cooperative approach with Al-Qaeda. But more so, I think it also shows that Al-Qaeda is trying to drive a wedge, especially in countries like Ivory Coast, which have got a predominantly Muslim north and very much a Christian south, which have already seen wars in the past before. Especially in 2010, we knew that the north were fighting against the south in the Ivory Coast, and we saw Alassane Ouattara going toe-to-toe with Laurent Gbagbo, and of course Mr. Gbagbo now facing a trial in The Hague. But I think the seriousness of this is one that Alassane Ouattara has taken to heart, because he himself has personally visited the site. He's beefed up security, and we know already that the intelligence services around the world are on full alert right now, looking and watching out for such attacks that may more than likely happen in the future.
So when the French ministers who are going to arrive in Ivory Coast on Tuesday, when they set foot in the country, they will be welcomed by the government of Ivory Coast?
Most definitely. The French would be welcomed with open arms, and they would be open to any other international agency or any other country that has the capability to be able to help Ivory Coast bolster its security forces to be able to cope with Al-Qaeda.
The annual flintlock counter-terrorism manoeuvres, which involve African, European and US troops, have just come to an end in Senegal. How helpful are these exercises for the African nations taking part?
Pivotal. Africa has got to show that it has a force that's fit for purpose, a force that can react with good timing, and above all, a force that's capable with the appropriate mandates behind it to be able to meet the challenges. And the challenges right now are very real, very apparent. And terrorism, be it Al-Qaeda or ISIL or many of its affiliates, is a threat for which everyone is taking very seriously indeed.
Ayo Johnson, freelance journalist and director of Viewpoint Africa.
News, analysis and feature reports. All that here on Africa Link.
And now part two in our five-part series by DW Africa correspondents Adrian Creech and Jan-Philip Schultz, explaining how a group of young Nigerian women became victims of human traffickers and were forced into prostitution. Isaac Mugabe has adapted this episode for Africa Link, in which we meet one of the traffickers who herself was once a victim.
In a dilapidated hotel room in Benin City, two human traffickers agree to meet with our correspondents, Jan, Philip and Adrian. The meeting comes after extensive negotiations. One of the traffickers, Mercy, explains how she helps young women who want to travel to Europe.
How I help them is that I will tell them the route they will follow, give them the connection. That is the way I help them, because they know that I have experience. But I don't tell them all my experience, so that they will have the mind to go.
Mercy herself last year tried to make it to Europe, but got as far as Libya when her best friend with whom they had set off the journey together died. So she turned back. Once again in Nigeria, a human trafficker asked Mercy to help recruit young women who want to go to Europe. The male trafficker explains how they came to work with Mercy, a former victim turned trafficker.
Because in the business, you know.
Because in this business, trust has to be important. We've known each other since she tried to travel to Europe herself. Someone introduced her to me to help her.
To help her on that route.
As soon as the young women's journey begins, a man who goes by the name Steve takes over. He brings them to Agadez in the Sahara. From there, another smuggler brings the women to Libya. Steve profits from his tight network of contacts. He knows when he has to pay bribes. Plenty of people are looking for kickbacks in the process of smuggling these women, from informants to the police. Others are juju doctors. Inside the juju shrine, many traffickers have brought their human cargo before heading to Europe. Here, the women are made to swear to pay back all their debt. The smugglers often demand 30,000 euros or more to bring them to Europe. The priest doesn't want to confirm anything on camera, but he warns that the gods will take revenge should a juju oath be broken.
Once he denies, the person will die. If you say he will die under 7 days, he will die by thunder.
The smuggler Steve gets 600 euros per woman for the journey to Agadez, about 500 kilometers from the Niger border. He says the journey through the desert is especially dangerous.
People might be robbed or attacked, or sometimes even killed in the desert. You can be robbed, and ladies can be raped. And besides, if you are alone in the desert, and your car breaks down, many people usually die on the road because there is no chance of any help.
Steve says that he rarely feels any remorse about the kind of work he does. He brings the women safely to the destination, and then his job is finished.
And that was part two in our series about human trafficking in Nigeria, written by Adrian Kriech and Jan-Philipp Scholz. You can find a picture gallery on the story on our website dw.com/Africa.
Africa on the move.
And this week's story for Africa on the Move actually began here in Germany, when two IT students from Ethiopia met one another and decided to launch their own startup. Nadina Schwarzbeck has been to see them, and her report is read now by Joanne Okitoy.
Emmanuel Abraha and his Kinda Mamo have launched their own startup in the heart of Addis Ababa called Ahadu Tech. The company develops programs for mobile applications or apps. The app Fidel, one of their main products, was conceived to help Ethiopian students.
Fidel is a web and mobile-based learning platform that enables students to access learning materials using mobile phones, tablets, or PCs so that they can learn anywhere, anytime.
The app is free of charge. Financing relies on sponsors on other apps, which Ahadu Tech has already launched. Abraha and Mamo are aware that only 40% of young people in Ethiopia go on to higher education. It's these students the entrepreneurs want to reach with their app. The idea for it came to them while studying information technology in Germany. And when they were there, they learned more than just IT. Abraha says,
and studying in Germany gives you like the opportunity to see the German quality or the made in Germany, the perfection. If Germans are doing something, they always make it like as with 100% quality.
But it works the other way around too. says his friend Eskinder Mamou.
I think Germany can learn a lot of things from Ethiopia. The one thing is, I think, flexibility. You don't have to do things just in a certain way.
Meanwhile, in Addis, they have problems to deal with, such as power failures and weak internet connections. At the office, programmer Nati Gosai is working feverishly on the mobile phone app Fidel. While the notebook version is already being used by about 5,000 students, the mobile application is still in development. Gosai shows us what he's been working on.
When you open the app, you have your different list of subjects, your progress for each subject, and you can download the questions to use offline. So if I wanted to work on math, it would give me the list of topics available. I can get a hint for the question if I wanted to.
The startup is not only developing innovative apps. It is also creating much-needed jobs. The company has already hired 19 people, all of whom completed their studies in Ethiopia. 15-year-old El Shaddai Kasu is in secondary school. She's been testing the study support app on her mobile phone for the past 6 months and finds it very useful.
It makes me to know many things. For example, when I didn't answer some questions, I started referring books and it helps me.
Now Eskinder Mamo and Emmanuel Abraha are planning to move their company to Ethiopia's Silicon Valley very soon. They hope to benefit from an exchange of ideas with other developers in the city's cluster. Also, they're counting on a much faster internet there.
And that report was written by Nadina Schwarzbeck. In Rwanda, the opposition Democratic Green Party has said it will pull out of next year's presidential elections if its demands for electoral reform aren't met. The Greens say they are aiming for a level playing field for all political parties in the upcoming poll. Longtime President Paul Kagame has already announced that he will be running again. Western commentators say the Democratic Greens are the only real opposition to Kagame's rule in the country. Nasra Bishumba reports from Kigali.
As preparations for next year's presidential election continue in high gear, the president of the Democratic Green Party, Frank Habineza, says that his political party will not be part of the race if its demands are not met. Rwanda's main opposition party wants the parliament to revise a law which regulates political parties in the country. For Habineza, the law prohibits political parties from seeking donor funding. The most vocal politician also wants an amendment on an article in the electoral law which requires a party to have at least 5% of the votes cast to qualify for government funding. The Green Party says that provision hinders a level playing field in Rwandan governance.
We wish that organizations from outside can be allowed to support political parties in Rwanda, but they can put a condition that if you receive money from outside, you declare it to the state organs. They can put even a limit that you don't get more than this money from a donor, and then you also give a report to the government. We think this can happen. It is happening in Uganda. It's our neighbor, and there's no problem. We think it can also happen here.
Frank Habineza also suggests that to ensure transparency and voter confidence, the law should be amended to accommodate electronic system of voting, which will work side by side with the ordinary ballot system.
We also wish that the election law could allow electronic voting system, but combined with ballot voting. That one would ensure more transparency and more confidence in our electoral commission, and people will be sure that their votes will count.
In a telephone interview with DW, Robert Mugabe, a lawyer and legal expert on Rwandan affairs, says that the Green Party's petition is legally acceptable and politically legitimate.
The law regulating political parties provides a lot of hindrances and a lot of obstacles for the political party to fundraise the money from, say, the country. Again, the political parties in Rwanda are not that mature that people, the members, contribute because they have something in return.
In a statement issued after the meeting, the Rwandan parliament said while members of parliament represent and serve the interests of the general public, it was up to the Green Party to choose a member of parliament or cabinet who would initiate the discussion on the opposition's requests. As the clock ticks towards 2017 presidential elections, the Green Party and its members can only keep pushing for reforms that will see them try their luck at leading Rwanda for the first time.
Nasra Bishumba reporting from Kigali.
making a difference.
Earlier in the programme, in our Africa on the Move feature, we heard about a startup in Ethiopia involving the launch of a mobile app designed to help students cope better with their workload. In Making a Difference, we meet another digital professional, this time from Zimbabwe. He's an award-winning innovator who wants people to see the positive side to life in his troubled country. Privilege Mushaniri in Harare has been to see him.
Self-taught animator and digital media artist Ngwizita Mlilo calls himself a student of the internet. In 2014, Ngwizita won an award sponsored by Google Africa for being one of Africa's top 10 internet innovators. Mlilo has taught over 200 digital media artists in and outside Zimbabwe. In 2012, Mlilo launched a multimedia production company called Nafuna TV. His passion is to tell a positive story about Zimbabwe and dispel the negative narratives that the country is often associated with.
You know, as artists, it's just our responsibility to at least portray, an undistorted picture of, you know, what we are actually like as a nation, as a country, as people, you know, based off the people I know, the relationships I have, the people I see, you know, working hard to feed their families.
Mwizita is credited for creating Zimbabwe's first animated music video in 2002. He has contributed to online 3D tutorials for a big California-based media corporation. He also contributed to the design and implementation of the foundational curriculum for Africa's biggest digital media school in Kigali, Rwanda.
It was a natural thing for me ever since I grew up. Like, I was always drawing comic books. I used to read a lot of comic books. My dad at least used to make sure I had like a nice supply every week, like every Friday. So I got influenced by that culture in general up until I sort of got into computers and the internet when I was in O-level.
This is one of Ngwizita's Nafuna TV productions called Angry Mwana. The story is about a child expressing anger toward a parent who fails to deliver his promises. Nafuna TV content can mostly be accessed online. The internet has enabled Nafuna TV to circumvent the bottlenecks caused by repressive media laws in Zimbabwe. There is only one television station in Zimbabwe, and it is owned by the state. A visitor is keen to see growth in animation production and to ensure that creators get a fair pay for their work. To this end, he has established Nafuna Campus. Its main aim is to find new talent, which is animation's biggest challenge in Africa. Karen Padam Kwedea is a young lady who came through the campus and now part of the Nafuna 14-member team.
Nafuna is putting the animation industry out there. You learn a lot from just the animation industry, the television industry and broadcast industry, how to monetize on it and how to make it a business.
Zimbabwe animators face funding challenges to do big budget projects. Few investors are willing to fund creative work.
Privilege Mushaniri in Harare. And before we leave you, a reminder of our main story. Two French ministers are to travel to Ivory Coast today in a gesture of solidarity in the wake of Sunday's assault on an Ivorian beach resort that claimed 18 lives. In other news from Africa, the European Union has suspended all direct financial support to Burundi because the government there has so far failed to stop a wave of deadly violence and is not respecting human rights. Please remember, we welcome your comments on this programme. You can send an SMS to country code 49 160 957 595 10 and email to feedback.africa@dw.com or a letter to Africa Link DW 53110 Bonn, Germany. Do join us again at the same time tomorrow. Thank you for listening. And from me, Mark Caldwell, bye now.